The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded as part of the IEA's new video series. You can find this and all of our other videos on YouTube if you'd prefer to watch. But for now, here's Mark Littlewood, IEA Director General, speaking to Johan Norberg and Dr. Steve Davis about globalisation and coronavirus.
I'm delighted to be joined today by author, lecturer and liberal scholar, as well as a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, an all-round optimist and good guy, Johan Norberg, and the IEA's head of education, Dr. Stephen Davis. Welcome to you both, gentlemen. It's great to have you with us. Thanks very much for joining us for this vidcast. You know what I'm going to put to you, that although globalisation has played a vital role in combating poverty, improving the lives of many, many millions of people across the world in recent decades, do free market liberals need to worry that that era is over, that the response to the coronavirus, a problem to tackle in itself in terms of human welfare, is likely to be in the direction of protectionism, economic nationalism, and those of us who believe in free trade and believe that we can point to its merits have got one hell of a problem on our hands going forward, that we are defending a brilliant but perhaps fragile system that has these sort of risks, some will argue, built into it. Johan, tell us your thoughts. Are we in for an uphill intellectual challenge when we finally emerge from this pandemic?
Yes, I absolutely think we have to worry about that backlash. You know, the world already had some pre-existing conditions before this disaster struck. We already had this backlash against free trade, globalization, openness generally, and there are reasons to assume that this will be strengthened for several reasons, one of them being that people begin to worry about the extent to which we've been dependent on everybody else for components, delivery supplies, ventilators, and so on. But there is also, I think, a possible strengthening of the pro-openness case. Because, you know, when you look around the world right now, we see it's a kind of a nightmare created by Greta Thunberg and the Swedish climate activist and the far-right populists. Nobody's flying, no one goes anywhere, no travel, no migration, no trade, and nobody really likes it, right? So yeah. For the first time, people really begin to realize the enormous benefits we get every day from trade and globalization. So I think potentially both these sides, both the pro and con side will be strengthened. So we're in for a fierce fight.
Yeah.
Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think that actually there's two slightly separate issues here that we need to think about. The first is the one you asked about and the one that Johan just spoke about, which is the debate we're going to face in the future in the aftermath of this pandemic, between basically people like ourselves who support globalization, free trade, economic integration, cooperation across national borders, really, and the forces of economic nationalism and protectionism, which, as Johan says, were already on the rise before the pandemic happened. This has basically, you know, played into their hands, so to speak, and into their agenda. So that's one issue, the debate we have to have going forward about that. We do have cause for concern because the historical precedents are that whenever we've had a major pandemic like this, it's led to a reaction which, if, for example, in the early part of the 20th century, in the aftermath of World War I and the great influenza pandemic of 1918-19, did indeed lead to a pullback from the kind of global economy we had in the 19th century. So there are historical reasons for being concerned about that. But as Johan says, there's also ways in which we can turn this to our advantage and say, you know, look, do you really want to live this way indefinitely? Never travel abroad again, or only have the elite travel over national borders. So there's that. The other issue, though, I think, is the question of whether or not, in fact, there is something about the way globalization has developed in the last 10, maybe 20 years, that has indeed made us more susceptible to a serious outbreak of this kind, and has also made society in some ways more brittle. For example, does the reliance upon very long supply chains and just-in-time delivery mean that we're much more vulnerable to the effect of a sudden breakdown than we would be otherwise? So I do think we, as liberals, we do have to take seriously the argument that there's maybe a trade-off to be made at the margin, not centrally, but at the margin, between economic efficiency and resilience, basically, and think quite seriously about how we work that out in the way that doesn't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Steve, I want to come back to you on that point, because that is really interesting. Let's assume or hope or pray that the kind of extreme case of anybody putting forward the idea that, you know, all international aviation should be grounded permanently doesn't get a hearing. But you've done a range of vidcasts for us, you know, showing how the disease, you know, spread and how they spread previously. Yeah. And essentially, they're along trade routes, right? So what would a liberal say to take up your challenge of, you know, with our system's brittle? Not that we're going to ground all international travel, but that, I don't know, you know, everybody coming in and out of a country needs 3.5 hours to have their temperature checked and their medical records looked at. Because if only we'd done that, then perhaps it wouldn't have got from Wuhan to Italy, and if it hadn't got to Italy, it wouldn't have got from Milan into London or whatever you think the route is. Do you think that something short of, you know, banning aviation, then let's assume that won't happen, but these sort of rigorous checks on free trade, you know, much more red tape, much more regulation, much more intrusion on people travelling, but also potentially on goods as well. And is that a price worth paying?
Well, I think we need to distinguish between what's likely to happen in the short run in the actual world we're in and what we should think about doing for the future. I do fear that in the next year or so, we're going to have a situation where a lot of countries, like New Zealand, for example, or South Korea, or indeed China, will say that you can't enter the country unless you agree to go into quarantine for 2 weeks, unless you could produce some kind of absolute proof that you have had the illness and been immune to it. That's going to put a severe crimp on international travel for about 2 years. Now, in terms of the bigger picture, the longer term picture, well, it is true that epidemic disease is spread along routes of travel. And in the modern world, when we have aircraft and widespread air travel, that means that an epidemic like this can spread very, very rapidly. If you look at the 1918-19 pandemic, the typical duration of the spread from one part of the world to another was about 4 to 6 months. Now, in this pandemic, it's been literally a matter of days rather than months. Now, that means that, therefore, it's much more difficult to control a major epidemic outbreak of this sort because of the rapidity of travel, but not impossible. What places like Taiwan, Singapore, South Korea have shown is that it is possible to have institutions and practices in place that enable you to enormously mitigate or manage that kind of risk so that you can still have the travel, but going forward in the longer term, but you don't necessarily have to run a really high risk of a major pandemic. That requires things like very good track and test if you ever do find a report that there's been a serious outbreak. What the East Asian countries have been able to do very successfully is to identify the initial bearers of the infection and then track and trace all of their contacts. And because they were able to do that, they had the institutions in place to do it, they were able to control the disease is spread without resorting to the kind of measures we've had to use in Europe. So that's the kind of administrative system, I think, that we need to have going forward. And that doesn't require extensive controls on travel or people's journeys. It just requires having a particular kind of administration in place that is efficient and effective. And I think we can learn from places like Taiwan how to do that.
Can I just add a brief aside?
Do you agree with Steve on that? Yeah. Please.
Yeah, because and it's definitely related, because we're always fighting the last war. Now people are going to, and governments are going to think hard about how not to be affected by a very similar kind of virus in a very similar kind of way. But before, and I absolutely agree with Stephen that globalization has made it easier for microbes to spread around the world rapidly, and it's quite problematic when it's a brand new disease jumping across the odd species barrier like this. But we must remember that most new diseases are normally just new versions, just a couple of mutations apart from an old disease, which means that most of the things that we suffer from, normally influenza strains, are a new version of an old one. And then travel is not the problem, but it seems to be the cure, because it creates a cross immunity against the new strains if you had the previous one. And that's one of the reasons why oftentimes those who suffer the most are those who were previously isolated. When it came to the swine flu in 2009, 24 yeah. of the 30 worst affected countries were island nations because they hadn't moved about quite a lot. Yeah. So this is some, and a couple of researchers at Tel Aviv and Oxford universities modeled different levels of travel around the world and show that, yeah, this, or well, whatever we had a month ago, this level led to widespread disease around the world, but that protects us from suffering from something much more terrible than we would otherwise have. They think, for example, that that's one of the reasons why we've not had a new Spanish flu episode in these last 100 years. So globalization might also have saved millions of life. The jet engine might have saved millions of life just in the last few decades. And we should remember that before we shut the world down. Yep.
I mean, that's a very important point. The thing is that people tend to think that the word pandemic means by definition a serious illness that's going to kill a lot of people. It doesn't. Technically, the term just means an epidemic that has a very wide geographical spread, theoretically global spread. And most pandemics are actually quite mild for the reason that Johan says there are versions of a disease that already has been around, an H1N1 flu virus, for example, in the case of swine flu, and which therefore lots of people already have partial immunity to. Unfortunately, every so often, rarely fortunately, you get what we have now, which is a novel virus to which most people have no immunity whatsoever. And so I suppose the good advice to governments is you need to have a system in place to identify which kind of disease you're facing. Is it the, you know, one in a 40-year episode of a totally novel disease, or is it something that's less serious? And therefore also have different systems in place to respond to those two different challenges once you've identified what it is.
Steve, you touched on this, but I'm interested in hearing from each of you. I'll start with you, Johan, about what you think from a liberal perspective the appropriate response should have been, or indeed whether the response has been appropriately liberal in a particular country. Johan, you're speaking to us from Sweden, which I'm increasingly describing as the last liberal country on earth. Sweden has definitely taken, at least in terms of legal enforcement, perhaps in terms of cultural norms, people are being compliant, but not down, if you like, the barrel of a gun, because they're choosing to be. If you look around, certainly Western Europe, but the world more generally, Johan, where do you think the response has been proportionate, appropriate, along the right lines? Is this what liberals need to accept the state needs to broadly do in these times of crisis, albeit we hope for a limited period of time? Or do you think, if you like, Sweden's got it right, or perhaps even you think Sweden's overreacted? What should be the appropriate liberal response here? Do we think governments are broadly doing the right things, and if so, which governments? Johan?
Yeah. Well, let me first say that there is some space to compromise with individual liberties in times of a crisis, of a pandemic. You know, I just reread Albert Camus' novel, The Plague. Right. And it's obvious when you suffer from a plague that's devastating. Obviously, you should quarantine the city of Oran, as they do in that novel, which is something that we wouldn't accept in normal times. But that being said, I think that we've seen a long series of overreactions and of mistakes being done, partly for the reason that the first thing politicians do in times of crisis is to show that they're on top of things and to act aggressively to, as one health researcher called it, to give people some political placebo. The placebo to make us feel good rather than really make us healthier. So, for example, one of the first things that happened was that flights were grounded, borders were built within Europe, trucks were stopped, the export of important protective equipment was blocked at the border. The French government even stole from Swedish companies passing through France to Spain and Italy. So, and that this has been a nightmare, because this is what we all rely upon. For example, thousands of Polish workers, factory workers, who go to work in the Czech Republic every morning to build protective equipment for all our hospitals, they were suddenly stopped since the Polish government blocked the borders. Mm-hmm. And this kind of political placebo is obviously, it's a nightmare, and we're going to have to fight against that. It gets more difficult when you discuss things like social distancing and how to put that in place. And I happen to think that we need it to not suppress the disease, because I don't think we can do that in the long run, but at least to mitigate it. And I think that Sweden might have, too early to tell, but we might have ended up in a sweet spot, partly because we have a sort of a very well-behaved or submissive population or what have you, who follow the recommendations. Sort of don't spend time with your elder relatives or your parents. We didn't spend too much time with them before the crisis, and we have the most single households in any country, I think, as well. So it could be that Swedes engage in this kind of social distancing voluntarily. You can see data from Google and Apple that we've really reduced our visits to restaurants, public transportation, and so on. And I much prefer that model, if we can sustain it, to something imposed from the top.
But that might be a cultural peculiarity. I think it was your fellow countryman, Fredrik Eriksson, who said social distancing at bus stops has been a social norm in Sweden for many decades. This isn't a change of practice. Steve, what are your thoughts on which governments have done what? You mentioned track and trace, I think we might learn from. But you know, is this proportionate? Is this disproportionate? Or have they done the wrong things and should have done something else?
I think that there's two slightly different questions again here. One is the question of, in theory, if you want to think about it from liberal principles point of view, does government in emergencies have the power to impose, you know, anything up to like the kind of very severe lockdowns we've seen, or maybe even more? And I think that, as Johan says, the answer is, provided the emergency is extreme enough, then yes. Now, I don't know, I mean, back in the 14th century, the guy who ran Milan at the time, Bernardo Visconti, he dealt with an outbreak of the Black Death by going to any house that had a case in it, and the people inside the house were just nailed in the house and boarded in, and they were left there for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, and then you took them planks off and found out if anyone survived. That actually did the job, you know, because Milan had only half the number of deaths anywhere else did in Italy at that time. But you might think that even, you know, even with the plague, that's too much. But I do think that if it's a sufficiently severe outbreak, then yes, governments can be justified on liberal grounds doing very severe and extensive controls. The question, though, of course, is how severe is it? Because I think the liberal principle clearly should be that you should do only what is necessary and no more than that. You shouldn't go beyond what is needed to achieve an acceptable level of control, given that basically you're not going to actually stop a lot of people getting the illness. The question is mitigating the effects of it. Now, that then does raise the question of, well, have we gone too far? Have governments gone and imposed controls beyond what was required? And I think, first of all, we need to distinguish between the situation facing the Far East countries and that facing Europe and North America, because the Far East countries actually benefited from being geographically close to the original outbreak in China, because this meant they were able to catch the cases very, very early. So the South Koreans were able to identify one supercarrier, which was, I believe, an old lady who belonged to a large evangelical Protestant congregation in Seoul, and they were able to identify her and identify all the people she'd come into contact with very early on. Now, they were only able to do that because it was such an early stage of the outbreak, and that was because they're geographically close to China. Now, with European and North American governments and governments in other parts of the world, that boat had sailed, really. By the time they became aware that something was going on, partly because of the disgraceful behavior of the Chinese government, I have to add, it was already out and loose. Now, I am actually prepared to cut them a bit more slack. I think the evidence is increasingly likely that Sweden probably has hit on the right balance, and that some of the other countries have been excessive in their response. But the trouble is, that's with the wisdom of hindsight. At the time the decisions had to be made, the politicians were not only trying to give a placebo effect, as Johan says, they were also being confronted with advice from doctors and the epidemiologists saying, well, look, if you don't do X, then you're going to get maybe 100,000 deaths or something. And you've got to be a very brave politician to get advice like that and say, well, okay, I think you're being alarmist. Because if it turns out that the person wasn't being alarmist, my God, you know, you're likely to be run out of town, not just metaphorically either. So I have quite a bit of sympathy for the reaction that governments have had. What they should do now, of course, is think about pulling back significantly from where they were. But that's actually, you know, again, quite tricky, because once you've put these controls in place, you have to be very careful about how you do them. I would add one other thing, which is that I think with, even at the time, it probably did seem likely that what would have made a lot of sense would have been lockdowns to a different degree in different parts of the country, certainly in the United States, where I think that it probably makes a lot of sense to lock New York City or Greater New York down very strictly. But there are large parts of the United States where you could have got away with much less social distancing. I don't know if Johan agrees, but I suspect that in Sweden you could have done with having perhaps more strict controls in Stockholm and less strict controls in the rest of the country. And certainly in the UK, I think London has quite clearly been much worse hit than the rest of the country.
Let me just put this to you, though. I'm no epidemiologist, and so the medical science around this, I don't pretend to understand. But Steve, let me just come to you and then give Johan the floor. I mean, it seems to me, from what I can gather, and my expertise here is simply reading the newspapers, that this isn't a particularly disastrous plague. I mean, the fatality rate is, I don't know, something around 1%. I mean, you know, that's not a large number of people, but it's not like the Black Death.
Yeah.
And furthermore, information keeps coming in suggesting that we can pretty much identify the groups that are affected. I mean, I'm not going to say no one between the age of 20 and 30 has died in Britain, but virtually no one. And yet 20 to 30-year-olds can't go down the pub, can't go to work. The problem seems to be very, very highly correlated with age. So there could be a different policy for the over 70s. And in general terms, although, you know, we're talking obviously about a very large number of deaths numerically, but it isn't something that is going to, you know, wipe out the entire population. Far from it.
Yeah. Absolutely. When actually, as the evidence comes in, it becomes, I think, increasingly likely that the death rate is less than 1%. I think the kind of converging point at the moment is about 0.7%, which still makes it seven times more deadly than seasonal flu. But as you say, nothing like the Black Death, which was 35 to 40%, or other kind of plagues in the past. But actually, I think the problem here is not fatality. That's the kind of thing that attracts the headlines, because people, even 1% of a large number of infected people is a large number of absolute deaths, and that kind of thing attracts a lot of headlines and puts a lot of pressure on the decision makers. The problem is rather, I think, that this particular virus has a very bad combination of qualities. It's highly infectious, and in about 60 to 80% of the cases, it doesn't appear to produce any symptoms. So people are infectious without realizing they've got the illness, which makes it very hard. The problem is that in a minority of cases, it seems to be about 5%, typically the elderly, whom you mentioned, it causes very severe symptoms, which are severe enough to require hospitalization, because it means you need things like oxygen treatment.
Even amongst the survivors, yeah. It's deeply unpleasant. Yeah.
And so the problem is really not that lots of people are going to die, it's that the hospital systems could potentially be overwhelmed by a sudden surge in the number of cases. And I think it's the fear of the hospital system collapsing that has really panicked governments around the world. There was great fear of this in Sweden. I know it looks as though, in fact, they've managed to manage things quite well in Sweden, and the hospital system has come through. Now, I do think this does lead us to ask some pretty serious questions, actually, about why we've moved to a hospital system which makes such intensive use of a smaller number of beds, because the number of beds per 1,000 population in Britain in 1970 was 9.3, I think it was. It's declined steadily since then, and it's now at about 2.3, 2.4 per 1,000 head of population. Now, we're actually doing more procedures, and we have a bed occupancy rate in the UK, which is never less than 85%, and at this time of year is typically about 90 to 92%. Now, that's extremely efficient, but it does mean that the system is
no capacity,
to any sudden increase in the number of people having to go to hospital. Now, the Germans, by contrast, have the kind of level of beds per 1,000 head of population we had 30, 40 years ago, so they've had much more slack.
I want to come in a bit to what we might learn by comparing different institutions in each country, but Johan, let me come to you on this, you know, the scale of it, and, you know, if it's a 0.7% fatality rate, are we overreacting? I'd also like your thoughts on the kind of point of liberal principle, that now the data's in, to what extent should we consider people's behaviour to be self-regarding activity rather than other-regarding activity. I mean, if 100 young people all want to go down to the pub and hug and kiss each other, they know there's a risk they're going to get ill. Let's put to one side the capacity in hospitals question, because that could be other-regarding. Let's assume they've all got private medical insurance and private physician waiting for them. Isn't it just self-regarding activity now? It's like, not practicing safe sex or something. I mean, we'd advise you against it, but it's not a matter of law that you have to use contraception or when you're having sex. Is it from a point of philosophical principle self-regarding? And do you think, from your understanding of the medical numbers, Johan, that this is an overreaction? I mean, it's unpleasant, lots of people will die, but, flu does the same thing.
Yeah. I think Steve is absolutely right. It was the hospital situation that panicked lots of governments in the Western world, because we saw what was happening in Northern Italy, how they were being overrun, and we didn't want to get into that situation. Then the question is, so how do you deal with that? And the Swedish response was not to suppress it, because there, what happens after a lockdown? Well, you will probably see a second wave. You might see an even higher peak as people get out of the lockdown. So instead, you try to mitigate it and slow it down while you increase hospital capacity. And Sweden also has the problem, very few beds. But the interesting thing is that we've scaled it up dramatically, more than 100% in a matter of weeks in Sweden, which tells you, and we're still not at capacity. We still have a 20% excess capacity of intensive care units in Sweden. We've just built a new field hospital in Stockholm with room for hundreds of COVID-19 patients, and that has not had to be opened yet, which is very interesting, because the data we looked at from when we tried to make Swedish versions of the famous Imperial College study, by now there should have been between 5 to 20 patients fighting over every ICU bed. Yeah. And that has clearly not happened. So it points to two things. Well, three things, if you include the fact that we shouldn't trust models too much. But it points to the fact that obviously it wasn't as dangerous as we thought to begin with, but also that societies aren't necessarily less fragile because we've mobilized everything we've got in advance. It is more a manner of resilience. Is it possible to divert resources and manpower to the particular surprise that nature has thrown at us? That should be the key lesson, I think, for the future, to think about those things. Now, I think I said that before we knew about this data, so I it's not just with hindsight. I think it was an overreaction in most countries back then, and this might be my conclusion now as well, is that, and it's the traditional John Stuart Millian idea that the burden of proof should lie on government interference in people's liberties. If we don't know for certain that this is going to help us, we should avoid it. And with these different models, we learned different things. There was a wide disagreement between the experts. Swedish experts said one thing, and British experts might have said something else. If we don't know what's best for public health, then we only know one thing. And that's, it's always bad to dismantle civil liberties and to shut the economy down, because we know that people are going to suffer because of that in the long run. So to me, it's more of a precautionary principle. And if we can manage, and again, Sweden might be an exception, so you are going to have to make that decision in other countries as well. But if you manage to have recommendations that most people follow, and yet leave some room for individual knowledge and individual needs to decide whether something is really important, if you have to do this kind of job, if that meeting is necessary, well, then that's much better, because we get the kind of social distancing that we need, but at the same time, we leave some space for local knowledge and for the economy to still function at some rate.
Could I just come in there quickly? Because I think Johan's made a very important point, which is that resilience, which is, I think, what we all need and want in this context, doesn't just mean having massive stockpiles or the institutional structures that I mentioned earlier in place. It's also a matter of how adaptable and flexible you are enabled, you know, and how does, how rapidly and quickly can you respond in a way that is also variable for, you know, with regard to local circumstances. And what a, quite understandably, a lot of the focus on at the moment is on government response and how well or badly governments have done. What we also need to think about is civil society responses and the degree to which ordinary people at a local level or a personal level can change the way they behave, make innovations perhaps in the way they work or the way they do other things, which enable society to be much more resilient when it's faced with a challenge of this kind. We probably won't know exactly what the full story in that regard is until, you know, sometime next year or even longer than that. But I think that's very important to emphasize, that because we're going to get a lot of a narrative which says that resilience means being prepared as though you're going to fight another war or something like that, you know, having a stockpile of munitions metaphorically. But it actually means being more nimble, being more flexible and adaptable. And that's where the emphasis really should be, on civil society, decentralization and local responses rather than government. You need both, obviously, but I think there's a danger of us forgetting the second part.
Well, that's what I wanted to come to, because I wanted to ask you, gentlemen, what you think at these early stages, however we navigate our way out of this problem, and whichever country's politicians navigate their way out best or first, what we might learn afterwards. And Steve, you've touched on it there, but there's three different areas, and I'll come to them one by one. I'll start with Johan there. But you know, what do you think we'll learn between what Steve's called society and government structures, but you could also say the private sector against the public sector? I mean, here in the UK, the NHS, a public sector behemoth, you know, we seem to find it nearly impossible to get the right sort of box of surgical gloves from a delivery office to the appropriate hospital. The private sector, the supermarket sector, unbelievably spectacular. I could walk half a mile down the road, the shelves are full of every good around the world. There was some bizarre run on toilet paper, but that seemed to be sorted out within 48 hours. Almost without exception, I can access South American wine, got fruit from all over. The private sector has been absolutely superb in the public sector. Do you think, I mean, I'm giving an anecdote there, but do you think, Johan, that when the data comes in, I'm not sure exactly what data I'd be looking at, that we will be able to make that private sector or civil society comparison to public sector institutions and find that the former have adapted much, much more successfully, and that adaptation is indeed a fundamental part of resilience?
Yes, I think this is an incredibly important point, because we have this almost instinct every time disaster strikes to wait for the big man, the strong man, the government, to point and all of us into a certain direction, and we should all mobilize like that. Which is obviously a disaster if the strong man points in the wrong direction. Yeah. And we always benefit from more eyeballs looking at various sections of society and how they can adapt to what's going on. I find it interesting that the first country that came up with a test for infections and managed to scale it up dramatically to an extent that almost nobody else did, was Germany, with its very decentralized healthcare system and a network of lots of private laboratories as well, whereas a centralized healthcare system like the French one, well, if you made one mistake in Paris, then you won't have a test. And that's what happened there as well. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. It'll take a long time to sift through all the data, but you see how rapidly the private sector has stepped up, how normally the producers of perfumes and of vodka suddenly produces hand sanitizer, how car producers suddenly switch to ventilators. Now, how could you direct that centrally? Well, you could tell them you're forced to do that, but how would you know that they are the best factory to do it, that they had the right kind of supplies and the workers who could do it? How do you know that that's a particular industry that we wouldn't need something else from? For example, something that seems trivial, but could be an important component in something else that's incredibly important. Only that particular company, those individuals know this. And that's why we really have to fight this centralization instinct every time disaster strikes.
And do you think, Steve, that will, do you think the data will show this, you know, knowledge is dispersed, and that, you know, it's the classics of, it's Hayekian spontaneous order or the invisible hand that seems to be doing the right, do you think that will be unambiguous when data and information comes in afterwards?
I think it will be unambiguous. The question is whether or not it will be recognised. So, I mean, another example was the impact of Hurricane Katrina on New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, where the FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, made a monumental balls up of its response there and made the whole situation much, much worse. Rightly got severely criticised, but what has not really got much attention, despite some very good work done by the Mercatus Center, was the amazingly effective response of civil society in the United States, both locally and more widely. So I think the evidence will be absolutely overwhelming that actually centralised responses to disaster scenarios, in this case a global disaster, are much worse than localized, decentralized, Hayekian spontaneous order responses, if you like. The question, this is a burden on us, really, if you like, as if you might say public intellectuals, is to get that message across and to make sure that people understand that phenomenon. Because, as Johan says, this is not the way our instincts work. Our instincts are to think, well, oh no, in a time of crisis, this is when you actually need a man on a white horse, you know, a general who will tell you what to do, which is all very well if the general knows what they're doing and happens to be lucky, you know, but if they're not, or they're an idiot, not naming any names, then, you know, you're going to get some seriously bad results. So we have to work against that kind of instinct. So I'm sure the evidence will be out there in vast amounts. The question is, what use do we make of it?
And Johan, I wanted to come back to you. You mentioned on the early evidence Germany's apparent success on its decentralized healthcare system. I think I'm right in saying virtually every hospital in Germany, it might be everyone bar one, is actually in private hands rather than state hands. But I'm interested in whether you think there will be, I've given the sort of first comparison, private sector against public sector. But this is also made for people who want to make country versus country comparisons. You know, which healthcare system in Europe was the best at building bed capacity, and why, which country was able to get ventilators delivered straight to the hospitals, and why, which, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And although Sweden, you know, Sweden's obviously taken a more liberal approach to the whole problem, but I'm not sure that was knowable in advance. It could have just as well have been Denmark taking a liberal approach and you taking a less liberal one. Do you think in comparing, let's say, across Western Europe, if we compare different public institutions in different countries, their public health authorities, the way they run their healthcare systems, that there'll be lessons there that will also point to more liberalism rather than less being the way to handle these things in future?
I definitely think that's the case. And one interesting background with the Swedish healthcare system is that it's not as every American thinks, a single payer and government organized healthcare system, one run by the different regions in Sweden, and then sprinkled subsidies on top of it. And we also have now lots of private providers in the system and lots of freedom of choice for patients. And that has changed. And that might be one interesting thing to look at. I think it's a bit too early to say who managed, who didn't, but we will certainly learn a lot about it, and I think we'll draw some lessons from it. But I also think we're going to do that within every particular healthcare system, because there are different sections that work and others that really don't. Sweden has been quite adaptive and managed to scale up a number of ICUs, as I pointed out, but on the other hand, we've failed miserably when it comes to moving, for example, important drugs and medical technology between the different regions. And that happens to be a bizarre regulatory system that no one cared about until 2 weeks ago, which said that, no, this is for use within this region and nowhere else. There's no internal market or anything like that. And we are learning that we can't do this in the future.
Yeah. To pick up on that point, I think one of the things that is going to come out of this whole crisis, which will benefit the liberal point of view, is the realization of just how many regulations there are out there, particularly but not exclusively in healthcare, that are simply bonkers. And the response, you know, I think will generally be, well, why did we have this in the first place? You know, it's because in a way this is like a stress test, if you will. And under a stress test, what you find is which kinds of regulations quite simply never made any sense at all. And I think in the United States, for example, the Food and Drug Administration is already starting to get a lot of well-justified stick from all across the political spectrum, interestingly, about the way in which its regulations have prevented a timely and effective response to the outbreak in many areas. So that's actually one of the sort of good outcomes, I think, of this outbreak from a liberal point of view. It will actually cast a pretty harsh light on a lot of, you know, aspects of the current system that we would be against anyway, but which, you know, it was hard to draw people's attention to before, but now it's become very obvious that these are no good.
I was very encouraged. I think just a few days ago, the NHS providers, which is essentially the trade association for NHS trusts, issued an interim report on how they were doing. And there is actually a section there where they applaud the red tape that has been incinerated and has therefore allowed people in the NHS, the bureaucrat, you know, to be much more fleet of foot in actually carrying out the work that they want to carry out, rather than filling in endless forms and filing endless pieces of paper to make.
There's one. Can I mention one historical analogy which I think is informative? Because lots of people, at least early on, talked about how this is a war, so we need a war economy to just mobilize all of the resources and get the equipment we need. Well, when you and obviously America's ability to scale up during the Second World War is often mentioned, but that's not really the story about what happened in the US during the Second World War. According to a book, it's called Freedom's Forge, and I don't remember the name of the historian, but it points out that, look, that's what the government did in the First World War, when the army sort of took over the railways and production and failed miserably, and the military equipment reached Paris after the end of hostilities. During the Second World War, they chose another path under the Danish immigrant General Knudsen, who used to produce cars, who told the President Roosevelt that, no, you know, all the knowledge is out there in these companies. You can buy things and give them a price tag, and they will provide. And then ask them, who knows how to do this in the best way, quickest and cheapest, but allow for local knowledge, and also, rather than lots of requirements and rules, deregulate them completely, because it's our manner of life and death. Who cares about red tape in that case? And that was the background of this tremendous surge.
The other comparison or part of, and I'll start with you, Johan, sort of, if we're starting to predict what the inquest might look like, is, do you think there are any, if you like, forms of government or institutions that will shoulder the blame here? I mean, I'm interested. There's going to be a lot of finger pointing. I'm interested, as far as possible, that we engage in, when the data's in, an empirical and balanced and objective decision. But for example, do you think this could lead to, and if it does, would it be justified, an outbreak of Sinophobia? That this wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the goddamn Chinese Communist Party, where it's impossible to speak truth to power. I've seen it suggested that this is basically China's Chernobyl, but worse. I mean, at least Gorbachev in the Soviet Union sort of acted eventually to tame the Chernobyl problem to some degree. Had he not done so, we would have had this, you know, a more global disaster on our hands. So do the Chinese Communist Party get sort of, you know, one in the eye? What about the World Health Organization, for example? They seem to have been completely useless. Do we need to scrap them? What about the EU? Or maybe it's not an EU competence, this sort of thing. But what do you think the inquest will look like for different forms of government? Well, liberal democracies have been seen to have been quite sensible, and more authoritarian states, you know, marched off down the wrong path. Will different international institutions face either reform or even possibly oblivion in once the inquest is in, about how they've behaved and acted? Johan?
Well, these are early days, so we'll see, is the answer. But so far, I would say, well, to start with some of these international institutions, I think that the EU showed itself from the worst and the best, in a way, during this crisis, because the first thing that happened was that everybody broke EU rules. So Germany and France, supposed to guide us, They implemented their own export bans and started to confiscate the protective equipment produced by other countries. Countries started to impose borders against one another. So it really showed that when, in times of crisis, no one really cares. On the other hand, one of the reasons why they began to slowly move away from that was the fact that the European Commission said that you can't do this. Stop the export bans. We can't have these lines of trucks with important equipment and food supplies and standing still at the border at this time. So rather keep it moving. So in other words, without the EU, this might have been even worse in Europe. But that does not mean that it will survive. If it turns out that there's this widespread sentiment that the strongest EU powers, they mishandle the situation dramatically, that might be very problematic. I do think that China will be will have a lot of questions to answer after this is over. They tried to get out of it after having silenced the whistleblowers by imposing these lockdowns and pretend that everything's all right here. But the only thing we know is that we can't trust them. We have no idea what's going on, really how many deaths and cases have taken place there. So it remains to be seen whether they even managed to deal with it locally. I don't think it's a great poster child for the Chinese people in any way. And no matter what they do, that impression will stick.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we can already say, and as Johan says, it's early days yet, we can already say that a lot of governments and policymakers all over the world will already be absolutely livid with the Chinese Communist Party, because they will feel that the Communist Party covered things up, refused to impose or failed to impose a travel ban until after Chinese New Year, which is a disaster when you think about it, because that's the second biggest gathering of human beings on the planet after the Hajj, basically. So there's going to be a lot of really angry people out there. The interesting question, which I have no idea how it will work out, is how this will play out within China itself, because who knows what is actually going on there, given the control the party has over the press. And we also don't know if there's going to be a second major wave of the epidemic in the autumn, which might hit China very hard. Now, historically, a major epidemic is one of the classic signs in Chinese history that the ruling dynasty has lost the mandate of heaven. So this could have some pretty serious consequences there politically, but it's too early to say. I do think that the East Asian countries are going to come out of this very well. I think Taiwan, Singapore, Hong Kong, as far as you can think of it as a separate country, and South Korea, maybe Japan as well, are going to come out of this very well compared to other countries. And then we can make various comparisons. With the EU, it's hard to say how this will play out. It could play out pretty badly. I do think that there's a certain style of political leadership that's going to retrospectively be seen as the correct way to go. Angela Merkel, of whom I'm not generally a fan, has had, I think, exactly the right kind of tone, if you will. So her personal qualities, if you like, of unflappability and phlegmatic approach is actually very successful in this kind of context. So I think we might have a bit of a reassessment of what kind of political leadership you want.
I would add the Sweden factor. Yeah. Depending on what happens in Sweden, someone will have a very difficult time in the next few months. It could be Sweden. It could be that things will begin to get worse in Sweden again, and others manage to get out of the lockdown without new cases. Our Nordic neighbors do much better than we do. In that case, you won't be hearing from us Swedes for a long time, because we have lots of self-doubt and questions to ponder. But if, and this for the moment, it seems more likely, Sweden gets out of this in a fairly good condition. We're now getting more people out of hospitals than into them. It seems like we've already passed the peak, whereas everybody else getting out of this lockdown will see a second wave. What happens then? Are they getting back into lockdown? Will there be a third wave? It could be that Sweden manages to do at least not worse than everybody else when it comes to health, but with an economy and a society that is much more intact. And then I think lots of leaders around the world are going to face lots of hostility and serious questions from the voters.
I want to end by asking you, you've given a really fascinating overview of the issues involved and some reasons to be cheerful. But I want to start, I want to finish by asking you to give us one reason to be optimistic from a liberal perspective, your key reason to be optimistic and one reason to be pessimistic from a liberal perspective. If we liken this, and I'm not sure the analogy completely holds up, but if we liken what we're going through to a time of war, our colleague at the IEA, Professor Philip Booth, sort of points out that the danger and the sort of accepted mythology about what happened post-1945 is evidence that central planning successfully achieved X, in that case, the defeat of Nazi Germany, suddenly became a reason to apply central state planning to A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. If central planning can defeat the Nazis, central planning can house the population, feed the population, bring education, numeracy, literacy to the population. So that might be one reason to be pessimistic. But I'll start with Stephen then. Johan, I'll give you the last word. Give us your key reason from a free market liberal perspective to be optimistic and pessimistic.
Okay, I think the main reason to be pessimistic is that this is, I think, undoubtedly going to lead to an upsurge in nationalism and in a kind of national collectivist politics, which was already on the rise before this, I think is going to get a major boost. So that's the main reason for being pessimistic, I think. There is going to be a great focus on what you might call Britain first and every other country first kind of politics, which I would strongly reject. The reason to be optimistic, I think, is what we talked about earlier, the way in which an experience like this can actually show the importance of decentralization, spontaneous order, resilience, private initiative and action. But that will only be a payoff, if you will, that reason for optimistic will only cash out if we do the job of making that known and winning the argument about it and getting the facts across.
Johan.
Well, I would actually agree with both of those points, but if I'm to add something, I think that a reason to be pessimistic is that we also have this economic nationalism in times of crisis, and people don't want to be dependent on everybody else for their supplies. I think we will see, there might be protectionism, but we will certainly, without a doubt, see more of picking winners, national champions. These industries are too important to be dependent on everybody else for. And I think it's slow backdoor protectionism through industrial policy, which I think is a terrible mistake. It's a good thing not to be dependent on only supplies in China. But, you know, had we concentrated supply chains only to Germany, for example, then we wouldn't have anything right now. No supplies in Sweden. It's only because China is beginning to open up that we're able to do anything in Sweden right now. So it should be an argument for more diversification, I think, and more flexibility. But I don't think that will be the general interpretation. Reason to be optimistic, and I agree with Steve. I think that we'll see in the end that the great solutions, the things that save us, they did not come from the man on a white horse. They came from civil society and entrepreneurs who thought out new innovative stuff. And that'll be important for the future, because if I'm supposed to be optimistic in a broader sense, I think that the good thing is that this wasn't the Spanish flu. It's not that model. It's not the Great Plague, but we know that something like that might happen. And it will probably happen eventually. So this is a great learning process.
Yes, exactly.
Great might be the wrong word, but it's a big one. So we are learning what works, what doesn't work, so that we're hopefully better prepared the next time around. Because then we could save, hopefully, millions of lives the next time death comes a-knocking.
Gentlemen, we're clean out of time, but my sincere thanks to you. Okay. You've given us a brilliant market liberal analysis of the problem, one that's reaffirmed my commitment to market liberalism as the solution, and also some reasons to be cheerful about lessons that we might learn from this dark, dark period. But crucially as well, you've underscored the challenge of what free market liberals are going to need to do to win the public debate in the aftermath. Johan Nøberg, Steve Davis, thank you very much indeed for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to host.
Thanks very much for listening. You can subscribe to all of the IEA podcasts on Podbean, Apple or Spotify, and you can check out all of the IEA's new videos on our YouTube channel, which you can also subscribe to. To make sure you never miss an episode, visit the IEA website, iea.org.uk, and subscribe to IEA Daily to get the latest news, views and reports from all of our staff straight to your inbox.